The small English town of Stratford-upon-Avon is chilly in the spring. Small white blossoms begin to burst forth from bone-bare branches, and oatmeal clouds trickle rain before gathering themselves up and moving on. Moss creeps up the sides of an old church at the edge of town. It nearly appears to be sinking into the emerald grass, along with all the gray headstones around it that the wind and rain have conspired over the years to make illegible. A wide river winds along the side of the church, and up to the modern playhouses that never seem to be empty of actors or spectators. It is a place where the new and the ancient seem to be layered one over another like paint on wallpaper. At the heart of this town is a cottage built around brown wooden timbers and a stone chimney. You have to duck to walk in. The ground floor is nothing but dirt, and as you walk up the small, creaky steps, you find tiny rooms refurbished with 1500s furniture and latticed window panes. As you look around, something catches your interest. At the center of the room, a freestanding window pane is displayed. Dozens of names have been scratched into the glass. Among them, you can make out those of famous minds belonging to different centuries, including those of Walter Scott, Thomas Carlyle, Isaac Watts, and Ellen Terry. Amongst the handful of well-known names, though, are dozens of scribbled names you don't recognize. A plaque next to the window honors the names of the famous ones, but makes little mention of the others. The small house is Shakespeare's birthplace. It is a particularly human trait to want to leave our mark on the world. All these people came here, signed the window, and are long dead. Yet few are recognized. All tried to leave their mark, and yet it seems only a few succeeded. Why? On August 4, 1914, Britain declared war on Germany. Most people believed at the time that it could hardly be called a war. It will be over by Christmas, they said. They could not have been more wrong. New recruits set off bright-eyed with a patriotic love of their country and a hope for glory. But as the landscape around them was decimated into gray, barren graveyards, as these young men and their friends lay dead and dying in the depths of muddy trenches, as the gas burned their lungs and explosions rattled their skulls, and still the war raged on without gaining an inch of no man's land, these disillusioned soldiers began to shut down. Glory, they discovered, didn't lie strewn across trenches with mouths agape, and dead men didn't bring home medals or tell stories of courage and valor to grandchildren. Some dead men did leave behind poetry, though, as bleak as the situation of those that wrote them. One such World War I soldier was Wilfred Owen, who wrote, "Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and toward our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas, gas, quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling, and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. In some smothering dreams, you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil sick of sin. If you could hear, at every jolt, the blood come gargling from with the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dolce et decorum est pro patria mori, or it is sweet and honorable to die for one's country." This poem not only elaborates on the horrors of war, unimaginable to the average citizen, but critiques those who glorify sending boys off to fight in the war. The friend, in Owen's poem, encourages children ardent for some desperate glory to go to war and die for their country in order to achieve it. However, the great irony is that the same friend made the act of saying, "It is sweet and honorable to die for one's country," attributes to these boys no honor. The friend isn't even simply encouraging people to enlist, he's encouraging them to die. This dehumanization is shown in the word choice throughout the poem. The supposed boys are described from line 1 as being like old beggars under sacks, and coughing like hags. Even the soldiers, not overcome by the gas, marched asleep, bloodshod, and went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf. Despite being revealed to be children, this old age imagery and deprivation of senses attributed to them suggests that they are not more than walking corpses. This is emphasized by the line, "Toward our distant rest begin to trudge," which could easily be taken to mean that the soldiers are all marching on to their inevitable deaths. Just as important as the descriptions Owen includes are the descriptions that he doesn't. Speaker makes no mention of any detail that would set the gassed soldier out from a crowd. No body type, personality traits, or even eye color. Instead, the speaker chooses to focus on the whites of his eyes, a characteristic that everyone has in common. The dead man is described with some fascinating phrases, though, such as hanging face like a devil sick of sin, as well as froth-corrupted lungs obscene as cancer. This word choice, especially that of the hanging face, is reminiscent of a criminal meeting his end. One of the most dishonorable deaths possible, with the friend's words as the presumed death sentence. Furthermore, the line "vile incurable sores on innocent tongues" is juxtaposed with the friend telling with such high zest, in order to symbolize the inability of the dead to speak for themselves, or to tell any tales that might bring them the honor they seek. In a way, the speaker suggests that the friend's biggest crime isn't just a naive view of war, but hypocritically declaring that honor can be found in death, when in reality, humanity, including the friend himself, only ever honors the things done in one's life. The old church at the edge of Stratford-upon-Avon teeters into the ground like a headstone itself. The graves around it are corrupted in mold and are half-submerged, drowned in the dirt. No one pays them much mind, or can even read most of them if they tried. The church, however, houses a roped-off section requiring a fee to enter. On the other side of that rope is a plaque set on the stone floor by which commonly lies a vase of flowers. It reads, "The Grave of William Shakespeare." Just as the people visiting Shakespeare's birthplace couldn't make a true mark on the world simply by signing their name on the window, honor and glory cannot be achieved by death alone, it seems, but rather by the things we accomplish in life. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. This episode was written and recorded by me, Nicole Grant. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did, and I'll see you next week on Rewriting History.